Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Since 2004, the Boston Red Sox have won three World Series, and Red Sox Nation has become a kind of regional cult about winning and devotion to a team. But 50 years ago, it was very different. In 1967, just 8,000 fans showed up for opening day at Fenway Park to watch an unpopular team of perennial losers. For eight straight years, the Sox had finished in the bottom half of the American League. They lost 100 games in 1965, and in one of those games, they drew just 409 fans. Few people expected anything different in 1967, but then the Red Sox started winning, and they kept winning all the way to the final game of the season.
The pitch is looped towards shortstop. Petrocelli's back. He's got it. The Red Sox win. And it's pandemonium on the field.
The Red Sox won the pennant, played in their first World Series since 1946, and even though they lost to St. Louis in seven games, 1967, the impossible dream season, turned Boston into a baseball town forever. So we're going to go back and look at that season with help from our friends at the Boston Globe, which has an ongoing series about that 1967 season and the summer that changed Boston. With me in the studio is longtime sports writer with the Boston Globe, Bob Ryan, who watched that incredible season unfold and has covered the Sox and just about every other sports story in town. Great to have you back, Bob Ryan.
Thank you, Anthony.
Yeah. And Gordon Eads is with us. He's a veteran sports writer and now the Red Sox team historian. Gordon Eads, great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Where were you? Were you in Boston 50 years ago for that impossible dream season? Did it turn you into a Red Sox fan for life? What do you remember about it that was 50 years ago today? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Bob, let me start with you. Bob Ryan, remind us of how bad those pre-1967 Red Sox were. I gave a few of the facts, but were they really that bad?
They weren't competitive. The only year, there was only one year after Ted Williams retired in 1960 that they were even remotely a contender, and I believe it was 64 for half a year. That's it. And then, as you pointed out, 65 lost 100-plus games. Drew, by the way, 650,000 people, or as we say today, 2.5 homestands. Seriously. And that is where we were. And then they upped it a little bit in 66. One thing I must say that I was only made aware of much later, no one was paying attention, but they actually had a pretty good second half of 66.
Yeah.
And we had the second best record in the American League after the All-Star break. Still, no one expected anything great in 67.
Yeah. So, Gordon Eads, why were they so bad?
They just some very mediocre ball club with a very incompetent front office filled with Tom Yawkey's cronies, his drinking buddies. I think you certainly can point to the fact, you know, the curse of the Bambino is a well-established storyline in this town. But for me, I would maintain that the more influential storyline was the curse of Jackie Robinson and the fact that the Red Sox were the last team to integrate, 1959, with Pumpsy Green, a utility infielder, shortstop. And a week later, they brought up a pitcher named Earl Wilson, who 2 years later, 3 years later, I should say, became the first African-American pitcher to throw a no-hitter. So
they were incredibly slow to take advantage, obviously, of that huge wealth of talent out there. Yeah.
And, I mean, one of the great stories, just talking about it in the office today, a famous Red Sox scout by the name of George Digby, the guy who signed Hall of Famer Wade Boggs, he had an opportunity. He recommended a 17-year-old center fielder from the Birmingham Black Barons, who the Red Sox could have had for $5,000, and they passed. And we could have had a decade of seeing Ted Williams and Willie Mays playing side by side.
Wow. Bob Ryan, that 1967 season, where were you? What were you doing? How did you experience that season?
I was in the summer in between my junior and senior years at BC, and it was the first time that I did not go back home after school. I got a job. I had a job that was the auspices of Boston College. 12 of us worked at the old City Hall on School Street, cleaning it out. We took inventory of closets, vaults, desks, etc. And that was my job. So I was in. I had a girlfriend. That was the whole emphasis. Was I had a girlfriend named Elaine Murray, 39 Glenmont Road, Brighton, who is now en route from Maine to Hingham, Massachusetts. We've been married 48 years.
Fantastic.
So anyway, that was the hook why I stayed in Boston. And we didn't go to a game until May, late May, doubleheader. They beat the Indians, and I got hooked. and I went. They were the first two of 27 games I went to that summer, which include being in the stands October 1, 67. One quick story on how that came about. I got paid periodically, and one day I got paid in late July, and I went down at the Red Sox office at lunchtime and bought some tickets for upcoming games. And I'm looking up at the big board, and after I buy tickets for five other games, I say, oh, October 1, the Twins are in town. That might be nice. I'll never quote. And so that's how we wound up with box seats behind home plate for October 1, 67.
Fantastic. Listeners, we're talking to Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, Gordon Eads, Boston Red Sox historian, and we're talking about 1967, the impossible dreams. He's in 50 years ago when the Red Sox went from literally nowhere to one of the greatest seasons ever in Red Sox history. Changed a lot of people in this greater Boston, New England area, made a lot of them Red Sox fans. I'd have to admit, myself included. And I want to read you guys a quote from Eric Moskowitz's great piece in the Globe, The Summer That Changed Boston. Here it is. It begins with a quote. We'll win more than we'll lose, the new manager had insisted, talking about that 1967 season. But when catcher Russ Gibson tried to wager $20 on it with the Globe's Will McDonough, outfielder Carl Yastrzemski cautioned the rookie not to be so carefree with half a day's pay. A 500 record, not a single man on the roster had played for a Boston team that had managed that. Bet him we'll finish sixth or better, Yaz told Gibson. You're giving him too much of an inch.
I love Ever that. The pragmatist, that Yaz Yastrzemski.
But I mean, that just goes to show there wasn't a whole lot of confidence even on the team. So when did it become clear, Gordon Eads, when did it become clear that the Red Sox were turning things around?
Well, I think Bob made a point that's pretty relevant to the discussion, is that in the second half of the 66 season, the Red Sox had started assembling some young talent that actually did win more games than they lost in the second half. And one of the things that strikes me, if you look at the roster, Anthony, of that 67 team, there are 18 players who played for the Red Sox that year who were 25 years of age or younger. Yes, who was stripped of his captaincy in spring training by the new skipper, Dick Williams, was only 27. But, I mean, you go around that infield, they were all 24 years of age or younger. And the other thing that jumps out at you when you look at that roster is, for the first time in the team's history, you had African-American players who made significant contributions. George Scott, first base. Joe Foy, third base. Reggie Smith, center field, a refugee from the Negro National League, John Wyatt, the closer, and then the great Yankees catcher Elston Howard picked up in August for the stretch drive.
So it was the moment when the Sox really sort of finally overcame that unfortunate legacy of essentially ignoring that wonderful pool of black talent out there.
And Dick O'Connell deserves a huge amount of the credit for that.
So we have to back up to the key hiring. September 16th, 1965, Dave Moorhead throws a no-hitter before fewer than 3,000 people. But on grabbing the headlines or equal sharing it was the fact that that's the day that Tom Yawkey fired Mike Higgins and hired Dick O'Connell to be his general manager. And Dick O'Connell is the absolute architect. He made important deals during the season. He changed the word wasn't used in those days, but in fact did change the culture of the Red Sox.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Were you in Boston 50 years ago for that impossible dream season? Did it turn you into a Red Sox fan? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bob, I asked Gordon the same question. You know, as someone who was watching, you said you went to those terrific games in October, but at what point in the season? Describe what it was like in Boston when people began to sort of take note that, oh my gosh, something's happening here.
There was a 10-game winning streak on the road in June into early July, I believe, whenever. But the point, they come back home, and there was a spontaneous gathering of fans to greet them at the airport. And this was astonishing. This reflected, though, the enthusiasm. That 10-game winning streak is when people said, whoa, well, maybe, wow. And then, you know, you're in the race. Now, the other thing to have to remember about this was a four-team race. It was extraordinary. And it went down to the last weekend as a four-team race. And yeah. And that was part of the fun of it all. There was so much. I mean, you're monitoring what are the Tigers doing? What are the White Sox doing? What are the Twins doing? Et cetera. And as well, it was absent from all this discussion in the was in fact that the Yankees, who were in the middle of the start of what was the decline period that lasted quite some time. Anyway, just so you know, the Yankees were no part of this, although there were some very memorable games the Red Sox played with them that year, as it turned out, but they were not part of the pennant equation.
Here's one of the memorable games. I want to just play this little clip. So this was a game against the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. Billy Rohr was pitching. He was on the verge of a no-hitter when Tom Tresh comes to the plate. Carl Yastrzemski is playing left field. Let's just listen to a little of this.
Rohr whines. Here it comes. Fly ball to deep left. Yastrzemski is going hard. Way back. And he dives and makes a tremendous catch!
One of the greatest catches we've ever seen. That's just by way of introducing Carl Yastrzemski and sort of what he meant to that team, Bob.
That was very early on.
It was
Rohr's first start, and of course it was one out in the ninth, and we didn't know at that point. Yaz was about to embark on what many people who saw it feel is as good an all-around season as they've ever seen any individual position player have. We didn't know that was, but that was the first. That was the beginning of it.
What happened with that catch? What did he actually do?
Oh, he went. It was over his left shoulder. He ran in the direction of left center field, and the ball was hit over his left shoulder, and he had to time it and make a leaping diving catch, which he did. Of course, the sad ending of the story. Was that Delston Howard broke up the no-hitter with two outs in the ninth and a single to right. Elston Howard, who of course would become a vital part of the puzzle in the second half of the season as a Red Sox. Yeah.
And the great aside to that day, Anthony, is after the game, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was at the game with her son, John Kennedy Jr., and they asked to be taken into the dugout so John could meet Billy Rohr. And Rohr tells the story, John Jr. asked for his autograph, and Billy Rohr said, "If I had been smart, I would have asked for John's autograph because it's worth a hell of a lot more than mine was."
He's an attorney in California now, Billy Rohr.
Fantastic. I want to introduce Tom Melville by way of bringing in first I'll tell you who Tom Melville was. WBUR's executive news director, happens to be my boss. Tom, great to have you.
Anthony, great to be. Anytime you want me to talk about the 1967 Red Sox, Anthony, I'm your man.
The reason why we're bringing Tom on not only because he's a great journalist and observer, but he was a kid. He sort of defines the kind of archetypical young Red Sox fan of that season. So, Tom, give us some memories. What did this season mean to you?
I think the most important part of it for me was that I was nine, and there's something about being a nine-year-old boy growing up in Newton Highlands, listening to every game on the radio. I'm that kid with the transistor radio on the pillow, you know. It was just an innocent time. I feel a little guilty when I say this because I've had a wonderful life, many thrills in my life. I have two great kids. I'm married. I've had a wonderful life, but the biggest thrill I ever had was when they won it on the last day of the season. There were four teams going into the final week, and they had to beat the Twins twice. Detroit had to lose. I was there. I was, the thrill that I felt in my bones.
And the thrill you evidently still feel.
I still feel it. I want to say to my wife and daughters, you know, my wedding day and the birth of you two, they were great, but oh my heavens.
I got to say, as someone who was 12 years older than he was at that point, and who's been a lifelong sports fan, as Gordon well knows, and loved baseball and basketball, and covered the Celtics through many glory years in Boston College when they were actually once upon a time very good in basketball. I hate to tell you. Anyway, that was, Anthony, the single greatest fan experience of my life.
Wow,
that whole summer. Just a snapshot. This is not hyperbole. I know it sounds hyperbolic. I know it sounds over the top. I know it sounds like fiction. It's the gospel truth. You could drive around Boston, and hear the whole game. Turn your radio off and at the stoplight and where you were, and because the guy next to you had the radio on.
So you would hear the game.
Walked around. I had friends in Cambridge that year, and I would go over and visit them at night, walk down the around the neighborhood. Everybody's on the front porch. It was an experience about radio and newspaper. It had very little to do with television.
Yeah.
The games were – there were 50 games on TV on Channel 5. They had the contract mostly on weekends. But it wasn't about TV. It was about radio. It was about Ken Coleman and Ned Martin.
That's right.
And it was about newspaper coverage of the Boston Record, the Boston Herald and the Traveler, and the Boston Globe. And that radio coverage was what made it resonate for us.
It was Ken Coleman and Ned Martin and Mel Parnell, the left-handed pitcher from the Red Sox for the 50s. He was like the analyst type. But those three dudes were just lighting it up. Oh, my God.
So it's funny that, though, that Bob, you say it wasn't about TV. And I know you're right, because I remember, too, listening to those games on the radio. But here's what I remember about TV. And it's a reminder of a couple of things about how different baseball was then. So I was in the fourth grade. My fourth grade teacher brought a little black and white TV in and put it on the desk. And we didn't have classes that day. This was the World Series. Mm-hmm. And they were in the World Series. And we got to watch the World Series in the middle of the day, which says something about the way baseball has changed.
1 o'clock start.
On a little black and white TV in our fourth grade classroom. And it was something like you, Tom. This was sort of my sort of introduction and seduction by the Boston Red Sox.
I'd been a fan. I went to my first game in 64 and Tony Conigliaro's rookie season. Saw him hit a home run. So I was already a fan, but that it to me, 1967 was the birth of Red Sox Nation.
Here's where we were, and it's unquestionably the dividing line in Red Sox history. Everything that these people are enjoying today, this regime, is a result of the forces that were set in motion in 67. Here's where they were with regard to the fears about attendance. They invited representatives of the local college newspapers down to Fenway Park for a meeting before we went home for school to ask, brainstorm. I was the representative of the Boston College Heights. Brainstorm what might we do to stimulate interest to get some people in the college community to come out to come to these games. That's where they were. They were desperate to find a new source of fandom in Boston. So that's unimaginable. That's where we were.
Yeah. Anthony, as great a season as Carl Yastrzemski had that year, and arguably it may have been the greatest single season performance by any player in baseball history. You could make that argument. Won the Triple Crown last 2 weeks of the season, 23 for 44. Last weekend of the season, 7 for 8. All that said, I think you could also say that Carl Yastrzemski single-handedly destroyed thousands of Little League careers, because every kid tried to emulate Yaz's stance where they held
the bat way up high.
You got it. You remember, Anthony.
Yep.
And that's why you and I probably both hit below the Mendoza line in Little League.
Did your family buy Big Yaz bread?
I remember Yaz
you
bread.
Must've.
Yeah, I do remember Yaz bread. I don't think my parents looked so fondly on Yaz bread, but that had to do with nutrition or something. But we got something a little bit to listen to, speaking of Carl Yastrzemski here.
Yeah, just came.
Tom, if you want to sing along, go ahead.
I could.
Tom, tell us the truth. This was your best Christmas present that year.
That's exactly where. So I don't know when they started marketing. This is a long-playing vinyl album called The Impossible Dream.
Fleetwood Records.
Out of Revere, Mass.
And they started advertising this on TV, and I don't know, Thanksgiving. And I never wanted a Christmas present so badly in my life. My parents would say, no, Tommy, we're not going to get that for you. We had enough baseball. You're not going to get it. And I got it on Christmas morning. It was so wonderful. I memorized the thing.
Yeah.
I can the poetry.
Go ahead.
Give us a little bit, Tommy. We'll fade out this Yaz song.
Okay,
give us a little poetry.
This is an important topic, too. Tony Conigliaro. We haven't gone there.
That's right.
And then one night, the kid in Wright lies sprawling in the dirt. The fastball struck him square. He's down. Is Tony badly hurt?
Fabulous.
Well, the doctors say he'll be okay, but he won't be back this year. If Tony's through, what can they do? Who will carry them from here? And then it goes right into bah, 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 Carl Yastrzemski. Bah, 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 bah.
Okay.
No, but it was a tragic thing. Tony Conigliaro played baseball at St. Mary's of Lynn, and I think within a year of finishing his baseball career at St. Mary's of Lynn, it's 64, and he's playing for the Red Sox. He was the youngest player to ever hit 100 home runs.
Correct.
He was a local kid. He was 22 in 67. He had a singing voice. He was in Hollywood singing.
I had the record. Too tight a hit, the Little Red Scooter, and Playing the Field.
He was a baseball god.
Now, I just want to remind listeners who might not recall or might not have been around, so he was a terrific athlete, right fielder, great at the plate. He took a terrific beaning, and he missed the World Series, came back, but he was never the same, right?
He came back, and miraculously, but in 1970, he had 36 homers and 116 RBIs, basically with one eye. And how he ever did it, we'll never know. And then they traded him to California, and he played as long as 75, actually came up and hit a home run early.
In 75, he made another comeback with the Red Sox.
Yes, he did.
He was the opening day designated hitter. Yep.
He hit a home run on opening day.
But I was there that night, and the hush on the field, and it was a crazy night. There was a smoke bomb thrown out of onto the field. There was Gary Bell had a perfect game into the fifth, a no-hitter into the seventh. Jimmy Hall hit a home run in the seventh, break it up, hit another one tonight, but all kinds of craziness. But that was the night though that Tony C got hit. I'll never forget it.
Let's take some calls. We've got time for a few. Let's go to Joanne, who's calling from Littleton. Joanne, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I was 9 years old and living in Newton Highlands that season. In fact, Tommy Melville is a high school classmate of mine.
Tommy Melville, right here in the studio.
Is this Joanne Wise?
Yeah.
Joanne Wise?
It's Joanne.
Joanne Derry?
Yes.
Hi, Joanne, how are you?
So, Joanne, what's your memory?
Good, how are you?
Good.
So, my oldest brother and I, we could ride the T for a dime. Yep. So, my mother would put us on the, she would just give us, like, I think she gave us $5, and she'd send us down to Elliott T Stop. We'd get on the T for a dime and ride several stops to get to Fenway. We could get tickets to go to the bleachers, and we still had enough money left over to each get a hot dog. And she would get rid of two of her five kids for a whole afternoon. She did that a lot that summer, and it was just the best. I loved that summer.
Joanne, thanks so much for that memory.
Thanks for calling, Joanne.
Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Franklin. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a 1967 graduate of the Boston City Hospital School of Nursing, getting ready to celebrate our 50th, and I am enticing my fellow graduates with some of the copies of the Boston Globe paper. But in 67, working on those wards as ready to graduate, the interns and residents, to try to get them out of the hall to come down and away from the radio, which I love that story about the radio, yeah. They would be like, but you grew up in Boston. We're not even from Boston, and we can't get away from it. It was hysterical. All these guys were just insane about every game.
Mary, thank you for the call so much. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I wouldn't feel right letting you, Bob Ryan, and Gordon Needs leave without asking a quick question about the current edition of the Red Sox. What do you see? What do you like?
What I like is the young talent. I like the Bees. I like the Betts, the Benintendi, the Bogarts, the Bradley, and I like that. You'll have to like Chris Sale. I don't think I think their best baseball's ahead of them. I think they have enough time to get the rotation straightened out. I hope that Eduardo Rodriguez can finally get healthy and pitch, because he looked great before he got hurt this time. Nobody's running away with the division. They do have a critical stretch right now. Tampa Bay, who's playing better, and then they come right out of the All-Star game with the Yankees. They're in it. They're going to be in it. I totally expect us to have a very exciting September.
All right. What do you think, Gordon?
I think it's very encouraging, the fact that even though we've had a season where we've already gone through seven third basemen, we've lost the knuckleballer Stephen Wright for the year. David Price missed the first 2 years, 2 months. Hanley Ramirez hasn't been able to play first base and hasn't been hitting. All of that said, and we're still in first place. And I would tend to agree with Bob that our best baseball is still ahead of us. Dave Dombrowski tends to be very aggressive at the All-Star break, before the training deadline, so I would expect some move or two.
All right, Gordon Needs, Boston Red Sox historian, Bob Ryan, Boston Globe sports writer. Thank you both for coming in.
You're welcome.
Today.
I hope you have some newfound respect for your news director.
And my news director, Tom Melville, and Red Sox fan extraordinaire. Thank you, Tommy.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you.
A lot of fun remembering 1967, the impossible dream season 50 years ago. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9. 89 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.